You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting artists in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. On this episode, we sit down with the legendary Kool Keith. Keith began his career in 1984 as part of the Ultra Magnetic MCs. The group's 1988 debut album, Critical Beatdown, is widely regarded as one of rap's greatest records. Keith and his groupmates Sed G, TR Love, and Mo Love were at the forefront of creating the sound of Golden Age rap, as well as broadening its lyrical styles. Keith in particular, with his expansive vocabulary and scientific terminology, created new forefronts in what rap could be. Kool Keith started his solo career in 1996 with the popular album Dr. Octagynecologist. Since then, he has released over a dozen solo records, as well as collaborations with a variety of performers. His new album is called Love and Danger. I began by asking Keith about Ultramagnetic's very first single, 1986's Ego Trippin'. On that song, Keith and Sed G take some shots at Run DMC, dissing the group's back-and-forth rapping style by name-dropping one of their hits. Say what, Peter Piper, to hell with childish rhymes, they say, and Keith complains about, quote, the simple back-and-forth, the same old rhythm that a baby can pick up and join right with them. I asked Keith for some history behind that insult to the now-revered group.
All right, welcome to Rap Genius Outside the Lines. I'm Sean, and I'm here with the legendary Kool Keith.
How you doing?
Hey. So I wanted to, obviously you've had a lot of stuff happen over the course of your career, and I wanted to begin at the beginning with Ego Trip. So on that song, on the Critical Beatdown record, right, on that song in particular, like I was just saying before, you have the song where you kind of take a little shot at Run DMC with the whole Peter Piper thing. Mm-hmm. Now, these days, the idea of saying anything bad about Run DMC is, like, unthinkable, right? No one would ever do that. Obviously, that wasn't the case in 1986. Can you explain a little bit about, like, the context behind that? Why you said that about their style and whatever?
Well, we didn't really diss Run DMC. We was just trying to cross the boundaries of the basic vocabulary style at that point. We was like, you know, there was always good lyrically with two people rhyming back and forth, but we was breaking it our style, that's all, because it was like a time to, we just used that as a break-in to go into another point of word play.
Okay. Now, you've seen, like, over your career, you've seen quite an evolution in hip-hop and, like, different styles and things like that. Now, when Ultramagnetic first came out, and for the next, like, maybe 4 or 5 years after that, it felt to me like rappers could have a lot of different personalities and still be successful, right? Mm-hmm. You could be weird, or the lover man, or the clown, or the street tough, or whatever. Sometime in the 90s, that kind of started to narrow, and you kind of had to be, like, everybody, the street guy, right? Did you ever feel any pressure yourself from people around you to sort of narrow your image and maybe get more street and less kind of esoteric?
Well, when Ultra came out, we was always street. I mean, we were street science, we were street sci-fi. We did all the hardest clubs in the world, basically. urban, throughout Philadelphia, Washington, New York, Connecticut. I mean, it couldn't get no harder then, but we used sci-fi hard. But I look at it different. Me and Sad grew up in urban life, you know, growing up in the projects, and him in the projects, me in the projects, Mo living in Brooklyn. So we had a urban experience of doing hard shows, and, you know, it was time when we were doing shows, we had to bring, you know, as a scientific group. I mean, I remember one time me and Mo, we used to bring guns to shows. But we used to put them between the mixer and put them in the DJ case and stuff. But back then, we used, you know, we didn't really have to use anything like that, but it was that we did a lot of places that was kind of edgy.
I believe it.
So, but we wasn't coming from a soft background, basically. We was a hard group. I mean, Seth came from one of the most wildest projects. I mean, the non-crew, and then my area was the same. So it's not like that. We were from urban lifestyle. We didn't have to prove anything.
Right.
Whereas a lot of groups that was hard on the street came from, like, nice areas, but they were rapping hard. Like, they lived that life.
Yeah.
But we were already in that life living, so we didn't have to prove nothing.
Right.
So that was the basic thing about it.
Nice. So you mentioned the whole, like, sci-fi science thing, right? Since the very beginning, you've had this, like, scientific terminology, science lingo and stuff in your lyrics. What's your attraction to that?
I watch a lot of movies and, you know, Star Trek and stuff like that. I mean, I was always enlightened by Leonard Nimoy. You know, it's just that I thought we had to take a different angle towards rap because everybody was doing the same stuff. So, but we were, you know, other than sci-fi, we were still doing reckless stuff too. I wasn't always sci-fi. I got different ways I can change sometimes. I mean, I did a lot of stuff, sex, sci-fi, horror, you know, that variety.
Yeah, so the sex thing, actually, that sex style record you did, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was, seemed to me, the first time that you had, like, the raunchiness that came with, like, bounce or Miami bass or whatever, mixed with New York City style rapping. Did you set out to create that kind of hybrid? Were you inspired by bounce or Miami bass or anything like that with the sex style stuff?
Well, Miami had their own sound of sex. They had more like a chant, like, you know, they, you know, like Luke and them had more like pop that, pop that. You know, they would say words over, but, and then maybe you had, you know, you had other rappers, you know, you had Too Short and stuff, but he was more like Oakland and stuff, but that was like more New York lyrical sex.
Yeah.
But me, I put a lot more into a lot of my records. You know, I coordinated the sound effects with the women and the movies. That's what I took to another level, putting that whole element into it, that different, you know, that real sexual experience. Like, whatever, I'll take a sample from a movie and use it, you know. Like, nobody did that before.
Yeah, and you took that really far. Like, I've read interviews with you about the sextile era of your career, and you said you really took that persona to the fullest. You really lived it. You were hanging out with porn stars, doing that kind of stuff. What other kind of personas have you really lived out during your career as you've sort of taken them? Like, did you take the Black Elvis thing that far, or the Dr. Octagon thing that far, or anything
like
that?
Well, I lived out. Dr. Octagon, I wrote more like Stephen King. I wrote that more natural, like, you know, about writing a book or a horror movie. Black Elvis, I wrote, you know, I lived partial Black Elvis because I was like, you know, when I did Black Elvis, it wasn't about me doing the image fun. It was just me being the lifestyle of traveling, the parties, the shows, the after party with girls. I think Sony didn't understand what I was trying to get across when I wanted to do it. I think they took it more in a comedic form.
Mm-hmm.
I was just doing Black Elvis, as to say I was like the Elvis Presley of rap.
How do you mean?
Just the fun, the lifestyle I had, like, you know, just everything that Elvis did, not musically, but just his touring life, Las Vegas, the bus, mm-hmm. traveling across country, going to stores, seeing. But, you know, I had a different type of fan base from everybody, too. So I had, like, all the different kids, you know. I had, like, it was like, it was just like my fan base was totally different from the average rapper. So my life was different. Mm-hmm. And I was on, you know, I was on big rock tours and stuff with big rock fans. And I think I was one of those rappers that broke that era of different types of venues. And, you know, like, say, the venues that were all over the world, I played first. You know, like, a lot of places where a lot of rappers that were urban never played. I played those places before they even started going there. Now everybody's going there now, all of a sudden, you know. Wherever it started, who was first, you know, maybe rock bands were playing there, but I think I was the first rapper playing at some of those places before, you know, I opened the doors.
Yeah, and speaking of firsts, you've claimed, rightfully, I think, a lot of firsts in the rap game, right? You had, you know, first person to use science lingo, the first person to use the 3000 thing that, you know, later was adopted by someone else we're not going to talk about. The first guy to wear their baseball cap tilted, even before you even started rapping.
Well, that was right way back when.
Yeah.
Pretty cool beat then.
Yeah. You had one first. You talked about one first that I was a little confused about, that maybe you could explain for me. On Entertainer Complainer from the Tim Dog record, mm-hmm. you claim to be the first man that created the brain.
Right. I just use that because I always used to rap about the brain. People say, yo, you rap about the brain. You rap about the brain in every song. So I think I just always used to have a fascination with the brain, but a lot of my lyrics lately calmed down from the brain. I rapped on a lot of records. Every record I used to say brain. Mm-hmm. And then it was just a fanatic word.
What was your fascination with the brain?
I just used to like to say it. Just in my lyrics. Just the brain. I'll take your brain. I'll throw your brain out the window. I'll beat your brain. I'll eat it. I'll take it out and play with it like a basketball. So I used to always have a big brain fascination writing about the brain. It was just a word I used to pick at.
Nice. I wanted to move back a second here, your influences and rappers you like. And all the time you shout out Shan, right, just in the end, on the mm-hmm. outro there. Mm-hmm. He and Kane seem to be basically the only rappers I've ever heard you say anything good about on a record. And I know in interviews you talked about...
I mean, Kane?
Yeah. And you've talked about in influences, Special K and T. La Rock were, like, influences on you growing up. Are there any other rappers you really like or who were big formative people for you?
In the early years, yeah. I like to... Everybody had a different style, but, I mean, like I said, the Treacherous Street, you know, T. La Rock... His brother, Special K, I mean, they were like scientists too. I mean, they wrote in the same way. And, you know, Shan always had a distinctive voice. Kane was always good, you know, lyrical. And, you know, I liked the rappers that had something different about them, basically. Not more rappers that kind of sounded the same or something. I liked somebody that had something special about them, you know, whether it was the voice or a distinctive way of rhyming. Or, you know, I think with T and them, they came up with the words too, the technical words, and, you know, they put a little bit of complexity into rap, because that's when the doors broke open to everybody using pronunciation, acquisition, modification, you know, those words.
The big words, yeah.
Came in. So, you know, it was good that I looked at people who did something different, not people who kind of follow.
Nice. Do you see anyone like that now? Anyone grab you as having something different, something special?
Well, a lot of people diss the new kids and stuff like that, but I don't diss them. I think we have, like, people... Well, I was always ahead of my time.
Right.
Lyrically, so time is catching up to what I'm doing. So the kids now is rhyming on the cadence that I'm rhyming now also. So... I'm not bad at the new kids because I was always ahead of my time, so it makes it more competitive for me. So, you know, I listen to the rappers now. I'm not mad, whereas a lot of people from the past, mm-hmm. they can't adjust
right.
to the cadences of. It's like a basketball player. You know, Kobe's still out there shooting. He's still serving. But a lot of guys quit because they can't really adapt to the cadences of the new kids. I mean, I like. You got Jadakiss. I like the Locks. I like. You know, you got a lot of new kids out. I mean, I'm not mad at Rick Ross. I mean, he brought lyrics to Miami, at least. You know, Miami used to be, had no definition of lyricism.
Right, the chants, like you said.
Yeah. So, I mean, you got a lot of people that brought a little more competitiveness into it. So it's good. I don't get mad because I think that my style is ahead of its time. And it's just right on time now.
Yeah, I want to talk
with what's going on with everybody now. So, and I still make the songs and the cadences that everybody make now, and the rhyme stanzas, and my timing is on. You know, I'm not jamming up on a record. You know, whereas back in the, you know, a lot of rappers can't get on those beats and sound more smoother because it's hard because the ticks.
Yeah. You say something like that in Extra Thoughts, right? You mm-hmm. say, I spit on the main floor, they rap on beat two. What?
I spit on the main floor.
Yeah.
They rap on beat two.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
It's like I spit on the regular floor, they rap on beat two. I mean, they rap in the basement. Like, when you press the elevator, they're on a down level. So, I rap on the main floor, they rap on beat two. So it's like, you know, you get on the elevator, the first floor is the regular floor.
Yeah.
And then you can go down, you know, you go, some buildings got B1, B2. You know, you got lobby,
mm-hmm.
B1,
B2. Oh, B2. I heard it's beat two.
B2.
Like something about the technique. B2. Okay, B2.
B2 means you're on the second level.
Nice.
Continental league.
Yeah.
You know, I analyze rap so much into. A rap is like basketball to me because it's like you got CBA rappers, you got NBA rappers. Like what I consider myself is like if it was a league, you know, you got your main rappers that come on the radio, you know, so they're gonna play with the Knicks as a media team, the Lakers are a media team, the Celtics are a media team, you know, team where you get press and coverage.
Right.
I would say, I would say I'm like Utah Jazz, you know, Karl Malone, members, and
stop
a lot of press. So yeah. It's like, I always played with one of the, that's when people would say, well, your career, you think you've been underrated and stuff. It's like, you play in the league, but you still play with the Jazz, or you play with, you know, a team like the Minnesota Timberwolves or something. So that's how I consider it. It's like, you know, you say another guy, you know, like Jay-Z would be on the, you know, Rick Ross would be Miami Heat,
yeah.
And then, you know, Jay-Z is the Knicks.
Next,
or the,
yeah.
You know, teams that get press coverage, but
yeah.
You still got players that are good, but they play on it.
I wanted to talk to you about Jay, actually.
Less media teams, huh?
I wanted to talk to you very briefly about two of those, like, media team rappers. Right, on New York, on your new song,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned Jay and Kanye West in mm-hmm. particular. What are your feelings about those guys? Why shout them out?
Well, I was reading in the magazine, Jay-Z was saying that, a lot of people like Keith, but Keith, a lot of people like Keith, but Keith, you know, he had his own opinion of me. But like he's like Keith don't sell records or something like to the mass appeal of people, you know, like Dr. Octagon sold like 200,000 copies without airplay or radio basically, but that's on an independent standard. So when you sell independently, that's like if you make money independently, 200,000 times what, $5?
Yeah.
You do the math. But the point is, I don't have to force myself. With a lot of radio, you know. I mean, you got guys that got record companies behind them, and they got to throw parties and, you know, press. They got to do a lot of, and they still can't even tour. They don't even have, like, they might do their record release party at a bar, and 30 people show up.
Right.
Still myself, I'm touring, I'm traveling, doing medium theaters, you know, doing venues, doing Coachella's, places like that, without a record out for 2 or 3 years, without a label, beyond it, basically. So I'm looking at the stronger definition. So I said that, I took it as like, it's a comment that he said that about me. I took it more like, I just said Jay-Z said I was king.
Right.
You know, he didn't say nothing bad, he just said, you know, I took it as he said I was king because, you know, he said people still like Keith.
Yes.
Like he was saying that, I don't know why people like Keith, but they like him. And that's a good thing.
Absolutely. So I wanted to, I was reading some interviews of yours.
On the Kanye.
Yeah, of course.
I said I was, I'm Kanye West in his prime, which is good. I didn't diss Kanye. I said, I'm Kanye West in his prime. That means I'm so new that I'm Kanye West in his prime. I mean, I don't know, how would you take that? I said something in his prime.
I mean,
Jay-Z said he was Rakim in his prime.
Yeah.
So, I just said I was Kanye West in his prime. But some people might argue and say, what do you mean trying to say Kanye West was good a long time ago?
Right, or past his prime or something.
Hmm?
Yeah.
I'm Kanye in his prime.
So, you've been a very strong proponent of not sampling. In recent years, right? You've even said that producers who sample are not artists, are not real artists.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised to read that, given that you're really one of the people responsible for how sampling is used in rap in the first place. You and Sed with the ultramagnetic stuff, using the grunt and using those James Brown moves and stuff like that. When did you begin to change your mind about sample productions? Did you always have doubts about it?
What do you mean?
Like, your early stuff, you use sampling, right? Mm-hmm. A lot. You kind of invented how sampling is used in rap.
Right.
And now you're against sampling, right?
No, I'm not against sampling. I just don't want to be involved with sampling because I want to, in my career, be an original, making music that I like and creating stuff from scratch. I don't knock the sample people, you know, like, you know, you have your niche of people. You got, you know, you got your Alchemists, you got Premier, you got Pete Rock, you got those guys, and you got, you got people on those side, on that side. Then you got the Timbaland, you got Pharrell, you know, you got a lot of the new guys. But I Sed G is on the side that's Premier and them is on. You know, that side is the sample side. And,
yeah.
Me, I'm on the new side, and they're on the sample classic side.
So
it's not bad. Either or is not bad, but
even back then, even back on like the first Ultramagnetic record, did you not like sampling? Did you not like the beats on that?
I like the beats on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I still sample stuff myself, but I have stuff that you would never think I might sample.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I might sample a record from India or something.
Right.
You know, I don't have a sample that has to be approved by all the sample guys, more or less. I might sample, you know, I might sample something off a Australian record. So that don't mean, I think people think that you have to have a certain type of sample to be approved as a sample, you know.
Right.
You know, that's what I was telling Kurt one time. Me and him had a conversation. We was walking through Germany. And he was telling me that, you know, back then a lot of guys had to collect a certain amount of records to be approved to be a sample. Or like if you don't have a certain amount of catalog, like CTI, you're not sampling like Freddie Hubbard, or you're not sampling Ron Carter, or you're not sampling stuff in a way of saying that I'm a sampler.
Yeah.
If you go out the lane, if I want to sample Rihanna tomorrow, they don't want to put me in the club because
right.
I'm using a record that's so new, but it's still sampled.
Okay.
You know, if I wanted to sample Drake's tonight, but if I rap on it, it sounds good, it's still a sample. But I think sometimes they have a boundary within the club that, well, it wasn't that vintage enough. It wasn't old enough.
Right, it didn't come out on this label from like 1966.
It didn't come
out
from 1966. Like, I'm a sampler, yeah. But I'm a wild sampler. I might sample, you know, Walt Frazier talking, you know,
yeah.
Before the Knicks come
on. I'd like to hear that.
But I'm just saying, I don't know what people, but then it's the side that I create new records also.
Yeah.
You know.
So you said one time, you said, I like to see a lot of collaborations that don't make sense. I like uncoordinated collaborations. What have been your favorite uncoordinated collaborations in your career?
Mine?
Yeah, yours.
Me and Tom Waits, that was one. You know, me and Prodigy was kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, it was another group I did, Regular Fries, those guys. I forgot their name. Just right into my tongue, they're real popular. Schwab. I had a couple. But, you know, I like to see some different collabos instead of all collabos being predictable.
Right.
You know.
Excellent. So I know photography is a big hobby of yours. You even made that song Professional Photographer about it.
Well, that's a true hobby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How was your photography style similar to and different from your whole aesthetic when you're making songs and making albums?
Well, I take pictures sometimes as a foreplay. I don't do the most necessary thing, like what some people got a camera, you know, you got a lot of people got Canon A1s, you know, they got Nikon D80s, Nikon 561, and, you know, the lens big as this. Some people take pictures of people on the beach, some people want to take pictures of the World Trade Place, some people want to take pictures of the Empire State Building. Some people want to waste film taking pictures of Manhattan. Me, I take pictures of girls.
Yeah.
That's what I do mostly. I don't really care to take a picture of a brownstone or a monument or a location or, you know, a bridge. You know, I don't need to take a picture of a boat. You know, I don't take pictures. I take pictures of trucks sometimes too because I was a big truck collector. Like,
oh, like the toy trucks?
No. My pops used to drive rigs, and you know, it was just all my uncles had rigs too. So I was into the, you know, the International, the Peterbilt, the White Freightliner, the Marlin, the White, the all these little trucks, auto car, you know. So I was into the trucks a lot. So I took pictures of trucks when I go to truck stops, cause trucks are decorated.
Yeah,
you know, some of them got beds in them. They got nice wheels, you know. I used to ride. Remember that show, Moving On, a long time ago? It used to come over. Sonny and Will used to be always traveling in the big track.
Yeah.
It was a TV show a long time ago. I used to watch that show. But, you know, I was into trucks differently. I'm a truck. As a kid, you know, you'd be like, my truck, that truck.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was always into the truck.
Nice.
We'll be right back with the rest of our talk with Cool Keith. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. We began the second half of our conversation with Cool Keith by asking him about the most unique gifts he's ever received from his fans.
So, you mentioned, you know, I read you like your fans to give you really creative gifts, that you have some really amazing fans who have given you really creative gifts over the years. That's another you're talking about. Your fans, you have a different fan base than most rappers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's reflected in the gifts they give you. What's the best and the worst gift you've ever gotten from a fan?
Well, the best gift I got was some girl drew something. It was a picture of it, but it looked nice. I had a guy that gave me a swirl I put on a table thing. It was really nice. I mean, he made these plates out of some type of painting, but they was like decorations. but he did it with paint, and it was swirls of different paint and abstract, and that was a good gift. That was like one of the best things you could sit on your table. But the worst gift I got was, I got a jar of pickles with pink with pink water in it or something. Like a big giant jar, and it had pink water. And he bought it on the bus, and I was like, do you want me to eat these? But I didn't know what kind of juice it was. It was just pink.
I can see
juice with the green pickles floating in there. Like, wow. Like, you know, you buy a jar of B&G classic, yeah. But this was a big giant, the big ones, you know. And yeah. It was pink. It was pink.
Did you end up eating any?
I left on the bus. And then, you know, later on, I just was showing some fans, and they was like, wow, that's different. But it was weird. It was a weird thing to me.
Okay. So, getting serious for a second. On Lost in Space, you have this lyric that you say, when I tell the truth. When I'm serious, you think I'm mysterious. Do you feel misunderstood a lot as an artist? Like, people aren't getting what you're saying, they only see the wigs and the big word, you know, science words and stuff, and they don't get what you're really
right. I'm glad you asked that question. I think people are locked in the fantasy world of myself. Like, they don't know the real world of me just off camera. They don't know, like, I go to Macy's, I get me a polo shirt, I go buy me sneakers, or I go out and have a drink. You know, I ride the plane. You know, people probably think I sit on the wing of the plane. They're like, how you get in? You know, I wait in line to get my ticket. You know, so I think people have a fantasy side of me where they're just locked into that fantasy side where they don't know the real, me in general, you know. They don't know, like, I make my oatmeal in the morning. They don't think I go out with some lotion and stuff like that. So I think when records are out, I think people lock into certain records. Like Octagon, people lock into those records, and then they want to live out the lyrics every day. But they don't know, like, one day it's raining, and I got an umbrella, and it's raining. You know, it's like, it's a day for me to just chill out and relax and make a sandwich, fry something. They just think the lyrics, they don't look at Stephen King that way.
Right. They don't think he's living.
When he comes to, like, pick up his trophy or his award, he just wears his tuxedo. They can't take it like that. They want me to wear, like, a mascot suit, you know, dress up like a chicken on the side and come to the awards and get the, you know, they can't see me never putting on a tuxedo and say, oh, best album of the year, Dr. Octagon, come get your trophy. They'd rather me come up there with R2-D2 and Darth Vader behind me, and I'm dressed like Chewbacca or something.
Right.
They can't take it like anybody else.
Is that the reason for your fascination with Michael Jackson? I know you talk about him a lot in your lyrics. You had that Michael Jackson impersonator in that video of yours. Do you feel similar? Like, he had, was kind of in a similar situation?
Yeah, Michael had the same thing. Like, people don't think at night when he's at home, he's walking to his refrigerator to get a cup of ice.
They can't moonwalk there or something.
Yeah, they he got a moonwalk. They can't believe Mike can't wake up at night and make a cup of tea.
Right.
You know, like, he can't a cup of tea and grab some cookies off the stove and walk back to his bedroom.
Yeah.
They think he gotta wear the whole suit and everything and put on his outfit and dance all the way to the kitchen.
Yeah. So you're wearing a lot of green today, and this actually ties into something I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. Green is, the color green's a really strong theme on the Black Elvis record. Why is that?
Well, I didn't do a couple designs.
In the lyrics, not even so much in the color design. It pops up a lot.
Green?
Yeah.
When you put it on the graphic? grain of the lyric. Oh yeah,
grain. In the lyrics, yeah.
Out of grain. Black Elvis was and that album, my theory was about money in that album. Because, you know, that was a good year of making money, you know. Green was a color of the dollar, and, you know, touring, making money, entertaining. Like, I had a routine as a rapper, like, that no other rapper has. Like, I go shopping before every show, because I like to smell new clothes before I go on stage. It makes me go on stage. Like, people never understood it. Like, I used to go to Macy's and buy a shirt and smell it. Like, a brand new shirt is an inspiration to me. So sometimes when people mess up that format, it messes with my mind. You know, I remember I told John Lennon's son that. He was like, so you have a format. He said, you have a format. That's weird. And, you know, we was going to work on something, but he never really... he was like, he understood it, but he didn't. But I was trying to tell him, like, I have a format, like a shopping bag, like Bloomingdale's, the little brown bag. It's such an inspiration to buy stuff when you're doing music.
Yeah.
It makes you feel good to buy sneakers and, you know, just the boxes of new. Like, the scent of new is an inspiration, like, new sneakers, new hat, new store, new tag, new. And when I was doing Black Elvis, it was like, I went to every city, to every mall. I parked my tour bus in front of Macy's, the Nordstrom's, the Dillard's, and I just went and bought stuff. I did the whole tour like that. Even when I did Warped Tour, I almost missed a lot of shows, but I never did miss one show.
Yeah.
I went to the mall every time. I looked at my set time, and the mall was 40 miles away from the venue.
Always is. There are always some really remote places.
And I went, I recall, I went to the city sometime. I even got a cab, like $100 into the city. And I couldn't make it back. I had 15 minutes before stage time, and I would always find a fan to bring me back from the mall. And the fan would bring me back, and I'd give them a ticket to get in. It was hard. And I would be coming to the stage with my bags. No, you know, straight to the stage.
Right,
my
right.
Bags. My bags, people don't know this, though, but my bags is on the side of the stage. So I'm like, I was never there like the rock bands rehearsing and practicing. It was just the rhythm. That's why Green was the inspiration of me, just money and trying to. Motivation.
Nice.
Green was motivation.
Nice. So I noticed something in a lot with you. When you want to say that something is whack, right? When you want to say something is really, really bad, you compare it to a movie soundtrack that's pretty rap heavy, right? You have that, you're coming so whack you sound like the Bullworth soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
or you're whack like the Brown Sugar soundtrack.
Right.
Why are those things in particular your standard for whackness?
Because they were whack. They were whack. I'm not going to bite my tongue. They were whack. They were very whack. I mean, that's what, I'm going to use that as a whack thing because, you know, that's a good comparison. So, you know, those are my phrases instead of being so bad. I use those as a phrase, but that's what it is. I mean, it's going to be there. Once I put it down, that's what I meant. And I mean, I don't mean no harm, but that's dope. They were very whack soundtracks.
Absolutely. So, Ultramagnetic, back together, getting back together? What's the story?
Well, Ultramagnetic been back together. They just trying to get in the studio and do things. And, you know, they're Ultra and me are sometimes uncommunicatable, and then we are communicatable because we're trying to see eye to eye on. You know, it's a whole different chain with me and Ultra because I've been traveling for years and then they wasn't.
Right.
They took time off. But it's hard. It's different times of an experience to tell guys and trying to get 3-4 guys to agree on certain things, you know. It goes from presentation, music, everything is kind of, sometimes it works a little more hard because you got to convince guys certain things, let's do this because this is the time for this. And sometimes everybody feels like they know it all, and they don't, but we're working on that. That's like the little handicap that they have, but it's all about listening after a while, you know. But I think sometimes, too, it's in their own ego. They can't take sometimes the criticism because they figure, like, why are you trying? You know, they don't want to take it from me because they feel like, oh, you've been doing stuff. But they don't see eye to eye once in a while. But we're working on it. But
new record, man?
Yeah, the record has to be, you know, I'm trying to tell them about, we're going through issues about different things and sounds and what should we do new, or you know, going in the crisis of the time, you know, you got the crisis of the people who are stuck in the time.
Sure.
Because I meet people all over the street, and they, like, they're stuck in a certain time. Like,
yo, I remember when Cedric used to use the SP-12.
I'm like, wow, I can't believe you are right there. Like, do you know about everything else?
A lot of people never get past that.
Yeah, they can't. Like, a lot of people in New York especially, they're very unenlightened to the new kids and what's going on around. They don't even know the latest rapper. They don't know. Even if you don't like it, it's good to know who's the latest person, who's the latest singer, who's the latest. Some people are so far out of reality that they're like stuck at some point, like, oh, remember when Ultra was, you know, you like everything. They stuck in that time. You could run into anybody, anywhere, and they like stuck. But you know what's funny? That's a certain amount of people, and that's why I know Seth say you don't go to a lot of events because you got a lot of gatherings where people want to grieve about the old time or a certain era so long. They're like, yo, I remember when that time, but let that time be that time and move forward. Mm-hmm. And some people, you got thousands and you got 100,000 people that can't.
Yeah. Speaking of time, time's been a big theme with you. Your very first solo album, you talked about the year 3000. So do you? And you've always been ahead of your time as far as lyrics and patterns and things like that go. Do you think you experience time like differently than other people, or a different view of it somehow?
It's funny. I could write a song. I wrote songs 10 years ago that people are doing now, or something, an idea or something. Like, you know, even dressing, you know, like, I've done stuff sometimes that 10 years ago people were doing now, and different things, like scarves or whatever. Like, you look at, you know, I'm like a time machine. I'm like Doctor Who. It's like, I can travel and press a button through any time. Like, I can press. Really, I can go so far ahead of rap, but it wouldn't be understandable. I have songs that I wrote that I didn't even do, and I read them to myself over and over. I said, I can't put this out. It's too ahead of people's minds. Like,
can we have a name of one of those songs?
Just like whatever, I wrote something. You know, I have a song called Elevator Sequence. Like, that shit is so understandable that it doesn't make sense. Like,
can you give us some of the lyrics from it, maybe?
I wrote it at home. I wrote two or three songs. Because I wrote, what happened was I wrote some songs with the big words and stuff like that again to see. I always could do that. That's the easiest thing for me. It's harder for me to rhyme regular than me to write a complex rap that's so far ahead, take your mind out of space. But I've been writing like that for years, but I have a different way of writing. My writing skills come from all types of angles, from girls to horror to, you know, the Freddy Krueger, the Friday the 13th, the whoever it is, Vincent Price. But a lot of people can't place me in one spot. I'm not in one spot, right? That's what it is. I'm not going to always come out every year with an album talking about champagne, I'm not gonna do my whole career about weed.
Right.
You know, you got a lot of rappers that do their whole career about weed. Like they gonna take a joint and they're gonna make 5 albums about a joint. I'm not gonna do that. That don't make you creative or nothing in history, basically. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because if you write movies, you gotta be able to write a variety of movies. Like different types of movies. You know, like you've seen Stephen King, he had Christine, he had different things, the clown. I mean, everybody had different things. You can't just run something the whole. That's like me writing 20 albums about this jacket.
Right.
Like, the Black Jacket album is coming back out again. The Black Jacket album is going to come out again. Another year, the Black Jacket album is coming out. That's what these guys are doing, you know. So they're running it as a formula because it works. But people are so dumb and retarded that they don't catch it yet until they realize, like, you know what? I really bought the Black Jacket album like 5 times.
Speaking of albums, is Love and Drugs really going to be your last record? As I saw that in the news.
Well, I am. I thought I would quit rap and start drawing cartoons. Because Rat Man got so whack. I thought I would draw a cartoon. I mean, I'm trying to strike this $300 billion deal with Cartoon Warner Brothers. Want to offer me $300 billion for the right hand. The right hand only. The right and the draw. But, no, I'm going to write for a lot of all the artists. I'm thinking I'm going to write some songs for a lot of some of the top rappers. I'm going to ghostwrite. I'm going to sit back and ghostwrite. I'm going to ghostwrite for a lot of the top 10 rappers. I might want to ghostwrite for them and, you know, lay back, let my hand do the writing for them, and they could say the lyrics. And I also want to do beats. You know, I got a lot of good beats. Head off a lot of the top rappers with some good beats and let them get on some more flows. A lot of rappers don't match a lot of flows of the beats and the stories. That's why I started doing production myself.
But you often do anonymously, right? Or under different names.
I program, yeah, our live set. You know, Skywalker was, funny thing, I produced Black Elvis, but a lot of people had to hide because they have this thing where the rapper can't do beats.
Right.
Because he raps. You know, P-Rock rapped, but he produced. But he sounded good. But I'm saying, I'm the other way around. I think I like to do a lot of beats that match a lot of my lyrics. I think a lot of producers can't match the intensity of what I'm writing sometimes. Sometimes I like to match the music up to the beats I'm doing. You know, it makes me feel good in the music. So, and I got a lot of, you know, I got my production that I'm calling, you know, KL Productions, which is beats, you know, the rappers out there want to get some beats. I want to produce some top rapper beats and let them get on some different type of things, you know. I want all the guys to call me. I want Jay-Z to give me a call. I want Kanye to give me a call. I want, let's see. Who else I got out there? Those two guys, I'm going to do some beats for them and give them some of my dope stuff. And I wonder who else I want to produce out there. I got a track for, I want to give Everlast out there. I want to do something with him. Get him a collab on something. And Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know. I want them to reach out. See, I think rap has no unity. You know, a lot of rappers don't reach out. And everybody has an ego. Yeah. And they feel like they can't, you know, meet and talk.
Yeah.
Have a little time together and, you know, come across a lot of ideas. Because everybody's so egoed out. You know, rock bands, they communicate together.
You've often compared yourself more to rockers than rappers over the course of your career. It seems like you identify, in some ways, culturally more with that side of the fence than with
rappers.
Well,
rappers. I do. I'm a rock star in general.
Yeah.
But sometimes I forget that I'm a rapper. I'm a rock star. I do rock stuff. I mean, I roll on the back of buses with the rock bands, you know, my tour bus. And, you know, I've been on the pre-buses and I had my own and toured cities from city to city, but, you know, year after year. But I want to reach out and talk to the rappers so they won't feel insecure. I think a lot of rappers are insecure because, you know what's funny? I see rappers, but they're seeing me and they're like, yo, we gotta do a track together. Yo, I can't wait to get on some stuff with you. But I think they're slightly intimidated too, because rappers got real sensitive feelings. Because they feel like, you do a track with them, okay, you send them vocals and different things, you fly them. Different types of rappers around the world.
Yeah.
They hear your lyrics. They get sensitive. They think you're trying to diss them. I'm like, yo, I laid my vocals for you to put your vocals on the track and we can just move on. Some of them may take it personal. Oh, he's trying to diss. Sounds like, or they may feel, I don't know what to say behind it. You know, just say what you say. But, you know, I sent Cormega some vocals. He put his vocals down. You know what I'm saying? Some people do it. You know, I sent Jesse vocals, but it's not the problem. I think rappers have an insecurity problem vocally. And like you said, some rappers get inferior. They feel like, well, I'm on a track with somebody that's good. See, a lot of people rap on tracks with people that's not good to make themselves sound better. But they don't want to get on track with people that's on their level to see where they stand. You know, and that's the point of being competitive. They don't like to be on tracks with competitive people who know how to write and say good stuff. They'd rather be on a track with somebody kind of on a lower level to make them sound good. But you're not going to get good like that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're winding down. I just wanted to ask you one thing about the early days. I know I was reading, you know, obviously you were around breakdancing even before you were rapping.
Uh-huh.
In the early days, people like Charlie Chase, Grand Wizard Theodore. What was that like to be there right in the Bronx as this stuff was really beginning?
Well, I was dancing when they was making records and stuff like that, but when I was small, like, Melly Melton was, like, large, you know, they was had on leather and Benzes and, you know, all the glamour and standing in front of the Roxy and, you know, coming up to the Bronx, it was like, they had parties, but it was a good life because it gave me more visuals of seeing that stuff, but it made me more of a natural Bronx rapper. You don't have too many full natural Bronx rappers. You got a few though, but you know, you got a few that came from the Bronx. But like I said, T. LaRock and all of them from the Bronx, AG, you know. But you don't have too many Bronx, but that feeling was good because it gave me more understanding.
Excellent. So I think that's going to be about it, but I was hoping, obviously this is Rap Genius, and we try to explain people's lyrics, mm-hmm. To the extent we can. I was wondering if you can get your thoughts about us and Rap Genius, and what we do, maybe we'll shout out.
Oh, yeah, what's up? This is Cool Keith. As you heard, my theory interview, I think Rap Genius was very good as far as dissecting certain parts of an interview to give people clear insight of lyrics and stuff like that. And I feel honored as well to answer the questions as Cool Keith, the lyrical man, the analysis.
All right. That's it. Spin Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Thanks a lot. See you next time.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show, audio, lyrics, and explanations can be found on rapgenius.com. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to one of my personal favorite rappers, Invincible, about her views on the Middle East, her memories of Proof, and why a great rhyme is like an eclipse. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. The interview was recorded by Dan Berger. This podcast was engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful 3Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Music by Psionic and Sir Loin. Special thanks to Nicole Witte Solomon. I'm your host, same old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.